Side 2, Tempus Fugit, continuing on page 42. Not mentioned in our brochure, but a regular on Sunday mornings, was a then unknown preacher named Oral Roberts. Mr. Roberts was the young pastor of a new gospel fellowship church in Fuquay. As I recall, to save money, Mr. Roberts served as his own engineer. In 1942, he decided to return to Oklahoma. Since then, he has become considerably more famous. For a two-year-old station, we were making an impression. We couldn't, however, just sit on our laurels. Then, and as we secured our place in the market, we engaged in rather shameless self-promotion, and some interesting promotions for our sponsors. For instance, several of us carried nickels in our pockets to put in the parking meter when we walked by a car whose meter was about to expire. We would put a nickel in the meter and a card on the windshield telling the owner how happy we were to have prevented his getting a parking ticket. I never was sure, however, that you could buy listeners for a nickel apiece. We also leapt to the motorist's rescue on the infrequent occasions when it snowed. We hired service station jeeps by the hour to pull cars back on the road, and after the rescue, the service station driver gave the motorist a card telling them that all of this was courtesy of WRAL. Perhaps the most elaborate promotion that we did was not for ourselves, but for Hadacol, a patent medicine that enjoyed a lot of popularity in the 50s. The old joke was, why did they name Hadacol Hadacol? Because they had to call it something. Honestly, that was, at the time, considered a joke. The company that produced Hadacol held a nationwide contest for the best promotion created by a radio station. Our entry was a variety show from the Ambassador Theater, broadcast over WRAL as a remote. To get in, you had to give the ticket taker a Hadacol box top. And when you got in, you saw a full lineup of local talent and some outrageous clowning by WRAL staff people. It was fun, and it was good enough to win the $1,000 second prize in the contest. Over the years, the promotions became a little more sophisticated, a lot more expensive, and sometimes purely mischievous. For instance, when CBS and its Durham affiliate, WDNC, tried to tell advertisers that they delivered part of the Raleigh market, we got busy and sent a bar of Ivory soap to the advertisers and agencies with the message, "The Raleigh radio market is 99.44% pure Raleigh." On another occasion, years later, we teamed up with other stations on the Tobacco Network to take a shot at WPTF. It was a full-page ad showing a giant Goliath surrounded by seven smaller figures. It was, as the headline said, "An open letter to Goliath from seven little Davids." Dick Mason at WPTF and I were friendly competitors for years. Each of us made every attempt to grab every listener we could, but we did it in good humor. Once Dick decided to make a direct comparison between WPTF and the Tobacco Network, he sent a mailer to advertisers that for several pages compared "The Tobacco Network says" to "WPTF says." When I saw it, I thought that he did such a good job for us that I was tempted to send him a check for the postage. There is one more promotion that sticks in my mind, although the reasoning that led up to it escapes me. We made the area's first newscast from a fishing boat. We broadcast from Captain Eddie Hanneman's boat out of Wrightsville, and I suppose we talked about fishing conditions. There were several of us from WRAL, plus our guest, Bill Ragsdale of Atlantic Richfield. We liked that one so much that in the late 50s we did another one and wound up with the first blue marlin of the season. It was a 365-pound monster, and my scrapbook has pictures of Ray Reeve, Jimmy Chambers, Tom Gatty, and me with the fish on the boat, on the dock, and finally in the Cameron Village Colonial Store. We took the marlin back to Raleigh with us, and he even showed up on the 11 o'clock news. Some promotional efforts involved me more personally than others. For instance, I appeared in more than 30 Raleigh Christmas parades. It is true that many people have appeared in the Christmas parade, but few have showed up dressed as a clown or in a red nightshirt, and fewer as a bunny, which I did. I rode in one parade with a red bow taped to the top of my head so that when I waved my hat to the crowd, I looked like a beribboned package. We also included WRAL celebrities such as Sister Gary, Paul Montgomery, Ray Reeve, and Betty Elliott. The parade was for years the highlight of the Christmas shopping season, and people came from miles around to see it. There were floats, bands, and marching units. The Recreation Department organized the pet parade, children with their pets, and the bikes, children with their decorated bicycles, for it. The parade originated at St. Mary's and Hillsborough Street. Then it went around the Capitol and down Fayetteville Street to the City Auditorium. Now that there's no real street on Fayetteville Street and the parade has to march down Salisbury Street, it's not the same. I really enjoyed these annual outings. It was one more opportunity each year to be in front of the audience. And I got good reviews. The News and Observer reported one year that I, and my bebowed head, got more applause than Santa Claus. That's almost as good as beating Arthur Godfrey in the ratings. Nobody in Raleigh should discuss the Christmas parades without acknowledging G. Wesley Williams of the Raleigh Merchants Bureau. For nearly 50 years, he was responsible for purchasing the Christmas lights that decorated Fayetteville Street and setting up the parade. When he retired, he was honored with a big dinner where a lot of important people applauded all the work he had done. Nobody deserved the honor more. I don't suppose the promotions that we used would do much today. In the first place, the parking meters don't take nickels, and I can't imagine filling up a theater now with people holding Hattacall box tops. A bar of soap to advertisers would probably be buried under a mountain of competing ratings reports. The Christmas parade is still held every year, but to me has lost some of its magic. But they worked then, and we made a place in the market, which was a good thing because I needed an audience for my show. Remember when there really was a Lake Boone? Christmas greenery and trees were sold on the state capitol grounds. Carl Yastrzemski played at Devereaux Meadow. Chapter 7, Tempus Fugits, Every Morning. Some people probably go through life carefully plotting their next move and then making it. For instance, my brother, Frank, wanted to be a lawyer, and he became one. He pursued a career. My younger brother, Floyd, got his master's degree in economics at the University of North Carolina, worked for the government in crop insurance, and served in the Navy, then started WTIK, his own radio station in Durham. The only strange thing was that the license for Floyd's station was granted at the same time as four other licenses for Durham. Instant competition. My own route wasn't so orderly. In fact, the morning radio program that I did for 16 years probably would never have happened if some people had been more dependable and I had been more patient. After the station went on the air in 1939, I went about my educational director's duties. If somebody wanted a tour of the station, I was the one to give it to them. If a school group needed contacting, off I went. I also did my on-the-air stint during the day, as well as anything else that needed doing. Then, sometime between 1939 and 1941, I was promoted to general manager of the station. I was still on the air during the day, and I was responsible, along with our program director, Larry Roller, for making sure we had something to broadcast. I was having a good time, a better time, actually, as an announcer than as a general manager. I had always thought of myself as an entertainer, and I liked people. Being on the radio was fun. Being general manager, however, meant that I had to take radio seriously. And one of the serious problems was that the morning announcers often didn't get to the station on time. At that time, the morning program was divided among several announcers and wasn't really identified with any of them. The morning man was supposed to show up, read the announcements and commercials, and play some records. The real shows came later in the day. The problem was that none of the announcers really liked the early morning hours. They preferred to sleep. And sometimes they chose to sleep when they were supposed to be at the station. All too often, I would get a call from one of the engineers saying that there wasn't an announcer in the studio. As general manager, it was my responsibility, so I would hurry down to the station to do the morning show. After months of this, I decided that I had had enough and would find myself an announcer I could depend on to show up. To start at that time of morning, the only one I could find was me. It took a while to find a format. In fact, the format that we had 16 years later when I left the air wasn't so much format as a collection of bits that I had put together over the years and liked enough to keep them. We just did what we suspected the audience might enjoy. I called it Tempus Fugit. As I mentioned earlier, I wasn't much of a Latin scholar, but I thought it had a nice sound, and at that time of the morning, time does fly as you're trying to get into your day. Despite its casual beginnings, it became the first morning show to become important to the station's schedule and profitable in terms of advertising billings, and I became the first announcer to be identified with a morning show. I often theorized that I could make my living before anybody else went to work. Of course, I wasn't the only one affected by my taking the morning show. Margie would get up every morning and have breakfast for me at 6 o'clock so that I could get off to the station. Then she would get the children up and get them ready for school. By anybody's standards, Tempus Fugit was informal, just something between me and the listener. I would usually stop by the State House restaurant before going up to the studio and grab a cup of coffee. Then the listeners and I would start our day together. There were a couple of reasons for this informality. One was that I was competing against WPTF and the NBC News. They thought, not entirely without reason, that the morning belonged to them. Since they had the big guns, I came on almost as a member of the listeners' family. Although I did occasionally remind our listeners that we had 1,240,000 cycles, they knew that WPTF only had 680,000 cycles. They also knew that all this referred to was the spot on the dial where you could find us, but it was in good fun. The second reason for my informal approach to the morning show was the advice from my mentors, Ray Reeve and Arthur Godfrey. Ray, who was a consummate pro at almost anything concerning radio announcing, told me not to talk to an audience, but to a single person. "Remember," he would say, pointing his finger at a spot just beyond the microphone, "you're talking right to that guy. Tell him stories." Arthur Godfrey and I were not as close as Ray and I. In fact, I only met him once. His secretary, Margaret Muggs Richardson, came from Raleigh, and through her good offices, I was able to get an appointment with the old redhead. His advice was much the same as Ray's. "Talk to the listener as if he's right there with you," he said. "If it's a beautiful night and there's a glorious moon shining, say, 'Look at that moon,' just as though you were both sitting on your front porch." Mr. Godfrey, however, did not stop there. He had a look at my bald head, snaggled teeth, and somewhat prominent nose, and gave me one more piece of advice. "Don't make any public appearances," he said. With all respect to Mr. Godfrey, one of the true giants of radio, I am happy to say that I took the first part of his advice, ignored the second, and had a great time. If you've ever entertained guests who didn't hold up their end of the conversation, you may have an idea of just how long 3 hours can be. Although I imagined my audience sitting right there with me and, as Ray advised, talked right to that guy didn't have a microphone and couldn't talk back. So, most of the time, it was up to me. That's where all the bits came in. Usually, I had read the News and Observer on the bus ride to the station, so I would start with a quip or comment on the morning news. It was the same sort of thing that the listener might hear from the person in the seat beside him, which, if the truth were known, is where I got a lot of the quips and comments in the first place. Then I might play a record, give the time and temperature, or read the announcements about what was going on in Raleigh that day. Some of the record titles were memorable. "How Fights Start in Barroom," "All I Want for Christmas is My Two Front Teeth," which I still sing in public every Christmas, wearing a red nightshirt and 2 blacked-out teeth. "He's dead, but he won't lie down." "Walter, Walter, lead me to the altar." "There's no one with endurance like a man who sells insurance." And, "If you want your freedom, PDQ, divorce me, COD." A lot of the songs were funny, and some of them were very slightly risque. I still claim that the good people of Raleigh were first exposed to Andy Griffith's first hit, "What It Was Football," on Tempus Fugit, and that I was, at least indirectly, responsible for his recording contract with Capitol Records. Andy is, of course, a North Carolina boy who had been to school at Chapel Hill, and "What It Was Football" was the record that started him on the road to Mayberry and Matlock. I played the record on Tempus Fugit and chuckled along with my listeners at Andy's description of the football game and his big orange. I thought the record had more potential than just local play, so on a Saturday afternoon, I called Don Comstock and told him about it. Don was and is with Capitol Records. Don expressed some interest in it and asked me to send him a record. According to Don, he and his national sales manager, Hal Cook, listened to the record, chuckled, and took off for Jacksonville for a call on Joe LeMaster at Stockton, Whatley, Davin & Company. When they got there, LeMaster told them about a funny record that he heard called What It Was Football. It was becoming obvious to Don and Hal Cook that there was something to the record. So Hal went to Chapel Hill and met with Orville Campbell, the record's producer, and gave him a $5,000 advance for the rights to it. Hal also signed Andy to Capitol Records, and for the first time ever for a record company, signed an agent-artist contract with Andy. In addition to making records, they booked Andy into hotels around the Southeast. The rest of the story is well documented on syndicated television. You can find The Andy Griffith Show on now in most of the major television markets. And it all started on Tempus Fugit. Incidentally, Frank Dupree, a longtime friend and now a retired federal judge, claims to have an even earlier involvement with Andy Griffith. He was responsible for the entertainment for the Lions Club banquet and hired the young UNC student. That was, according to Frank, the first time Andy got paid to entertain. Occasionally, I would subject the audience to one of my own renditions. After all, it was my microphone, and the listeners knew that it would be over soon. Once, I recall, Paul Montgomery, who is, of course, a real musician, Camilla, his wife and a station employee, and I got together for a truly memorable performance of Keep on the Sunny Side and Up the River. We had fun, and the audience endured. Then, in between records and other attempts at music, I would do things to either entertain or inform the listener, or, if I was lucky, both. For instance, we had the Trading Post, a sort of on-the-air swap shop. I'd open the segment by calling in my best town crier voice, hear ye, it's time for the old Trading Post. Then we would read the items that listeners wanted to trade. Maybe a half a bottle of Chanel No. 5 for a dozen diapers, or a fishing rod for a golf club. Sometimes they wanted to trade what they had, a kitchen appliance or an old car perhaps, for money. In other words, an outright sale. It didn't matter. Whatever the listeners had that they wanted to get rid of, we were glad to help. And we managed to move more than one truckload of household goods from our trading post. There is still one citizen of Raleigh who greets me whenever he sees me on the street with a, hear ye." I guess he must have enjoyed the trading post. Another bit, similar to the trading post, was lost and found. Listeners would call in, leave a description of an item that had been lost, and during the lost and found segment, we would broadcast the description of the item. If someone found it, they could call us, and we would see that the item got to the owner. Usually, Lost and Found was full of dogs and cats, keys, kids' bikes, and things like that. One day, however, someone found a mule and brought it to us. There is still some question as to whether the mule was really lost or someone was making a statement about the man who ran the Lost and Found. In any event, we parked the mule in a parking place outside the station and tied him to the meter. We put a sign on the mule that said, Mule found by Tempus Fugit. Owner call for at WRAL. Then we broadcast the item as usual and kept feeding the mule and the meter until the owner came to claim it. It was probably Lost and Found that gave me my first taste of the inconveniences of being a celebrity. Margie and I began to get calls at home at all hours from people who wanted to have something listed on Lost and Found. Finally, we had to get an unlisted number just so we could have breakfast or dinner in peace. About 9:15 every morning, we would welcome all the newborns in Raleigh by announcing their births on the show. Our contacts at Rex and Mary Elizabeth Hospitals would give us the names of the parents of any babies born since the last show, the weight and sex of the baby, and if the baby had been named, the name of the baby. It was, you would think, an innocent enough thing to do. However, at one point, the hospitals wouldn't release the information, but as they say, we had our ways. Along with births, we celebrated birthdays. More than one citizen of Raleigh has cringed on the way to work when he found that his wife had alerted the entire city to his 40th birthday over WRAL. And a lot of small children got a thrill hearing their name over the air because their mothers had called us. It was a simple bit. We would announce the names, and then I would sing, "Happy Birthday." I suppose the good-natured people of Raleigh were willing to put up with my singing to join in the celebration of the birthdays. Raleigh's mayor, Jimmy Briggs, had a hand in Tempest Fugit's format. He was a fisherman, so he wanted fishing reports. In fact, after we got this bit started, he even did a few of them. We developed local sources as well as checking in with friends on the coast, such as Acock Brown at Nag's Head, Axon Smith at Bellhaven, Bob Simpson at Moorhead, and Eddie Hanneman at Wrightsville Beach. The thing all of these bits had in common, aside from sounding somewhat rustic in this day and age, is that they were all part of the everyday lives of the people. Our citizens being born, growing up and growing old, losing and finding things, or buying, selling, and trading. That's what they did every day, so we helped them. Not everything on Tempest Fugit was of an everyday nature, however. There was, for instance, the music of Mrs. Florence Foster Jenkins, a wealthy matron who thought that she could sing grand opera. Her accompanist had the unlikely name of Cosme McMoon. In those days, it was not that unusual to have opera or operetta music on the radio. The problem was that opinion was sharply divided as to whether Florence Foster Jenkins could sing or not. On the not side were most music lovers and musicians and all record companies. On the could side, there was, unfortunately, my mother. Since F.F. Jenkins had enough money to make records of his wife's renditions and book theaters for her performances, and since Mrs. Fletcher had considerable influence with both the general manager of WRAL and the host of Tempest Fugit, we were occasionally put in the position of airing Mrs. Jenkins' latest aria. I would usually give it some sort of gracious introduction, such as, "Now, folks, I have to play some good music, or my mother, Miss Lizzie, will whip me." Then I would play Mrs. Jenkins' aria. I'm sure that the audience enjoyed it about as much as a trip to the dentist. But, like the trip to the dentist, it did end, and we could get on to other things. Like the fairy tales. Chapter 8. The Fairy Tale Man. It was around the fall of 1941 that the fairy tales became a regular 8 o'clock feature on Tempest Fugit, and probably there has never been another practical necessity that turned out to be so much fun. As I've already mentioned, WPTF and the NBC News felt like the morning belonged to them. They not only had the most respected news show on radio, but they had those 50,000 watts to blast it out with. Obviously, we were not going to make a lot of headway by running a news show directly opposite them. The idea originated with Joe Weed, then our representative in New York. They felt like we could get to the audience through the children. If, they reasoned, there was a conflict between the parents and the kids for the radio, the kids would win. So, the idea was to come up with something that would appeal to the school kids. When you think about it, the options for a single announcer in a studio and no particular budget for youthful programming are pretty slim. We decided on fairy tales. I could read them. The cost was minimal. One book of Grimm's fairy tales. And they were promotable. We would begin promoting the morning's fairy tale about 7:15 and plug it right up to the news at 7:45. When we came out of the news, I would read the story for the children. It wasn't an elaborate production. If there were sounds, wolves blowing down houses, skies falling, things like that, I would create the sound effects. I remember approximating the sound of a knock on the door by knocking on my own bald head. It sounded amazingly like someone knocking on a wooden door. I also had sounds for movement. When the fox chased the fox ran boogity, boogity, boogity in pursuit as the rabbit fled by hopping elippity, elippity, elippity. Then there were the voices, male, female, old and young, witches, giants, lions, and mice. I got to the point that I could switch between Ducky Lucky and Chicken Little without missing a beat. Whenever I had a chance, I would give the fairy tale a local flavor by working in a local landmark. For instance, I had the last little pig, instead of going to town, on his way to the state fair. I would also toss in an editorial comment or two, either to the kids or to the parents. Sometimes it was to point up the moral, sometimes to add some suspense, but most of the time it was just because I saw the chance to get a chuckle. It worked. About 2 months after we started telling fairy tales, the ratings came out and we were doing well. And the ratings continued to go up, enough that the stations down east picked it up. We were doing Rapunzel and Rumpelstiltskin all over eastern North Carolina. Among my souvenirs of Tempest Fugit, there is a brochure peddling the fairy tales to other radio stations. On the front, in red, white, and black, the headline says, "No Blood and Thunder." This was an early effort to eliminate violence in the media, because on the inside, we boasted that there were no gangsters' bullets, no flying bodies. These are once-upon-a-time stories with plenty of good morals for the kids and plenty of comedy and action for the adults. It's true that we didn't have gangsters' bullets, just witches trying to push Hansel and Gretel into the oven. But it's also true that both the kids and the adults enjoyed them. In fact, among the hundreds of letters we received from parents, there are dozens like the one that said, "I am not a child, nor do I have any children, but I get a kick out of listening to your fairy tales for the children in the morning." This listener, like a lot of others, stumbled on the fairy tales and decided she liked this bit of make-believe. Our letters showed that we had an audience that covered the human spectrum. Young, old, male, female, blue-collar, white-collar, urban, rural, well-educated, and hardly educated at all. We knew that among our listeners we counted taxi drivers, retail clerks, policemen, firemen, grandmothers, lawyers, and one National Guard general, General Van B. Metz. By 1945, the Conland surveys showed that we had a 16.1 rating against a rating of 15.3 for the NBC World News. Among the eastern North Carolina stations, we had an 11.8 rating. Everybody else combined had a 7.0. In fact, if you can believe our promotion, we made a real difference in the world of bread. In 1945, Bell Bakeries began to sponsor the Fairy Tale Man over some 24 stations. They even offered free fairy tale pictures and free albums. During that time, according to the brochure, other bakeries in North Carolina had, and we did it this way so the reader wouldn't miss the point, a business decline up to 28%. On the other hand, Bell Bakeries, my sponsor, was 26% above the previous year. A pretty good hit for Red Riding Hood and for Roger Black, the baker. We had become, I understand, both a time mark and a disciplinary tool in the morning. The mothers would tell the children, "If you're not ready when the fairy tale man comes on, there'll be no fairy tale for you this morning." So I got to be the fairy tale man. I didn't mean to, but the listeners liked it. I also got to be the tallest person in the children's section of the library as I looked for new material. I ran through the Brothers Grimm, Hans Christian Andersen, Aesop, and anybody else who started a story with "Once Upon a Time." In fact, by the time the brochure was printed, we said that we already had 65 stories and more were being transcribed. I should note here that all of my fairy tales were not classic. One winter's day, I got a call from Pat Phelan, the manager of the Raleigh Montgomery Ward store, about a story they were using for promotion. He thought it would be something I could use around Christmas, since it involved Santa and reindeer and sleighs. I did, and the children of Raleigh were treated to what was probably the first broadcast of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, long before Gene Autry made the record. As a part of my fairy tale fame, I was invited to elementary schools all around Raleigh, and I got a real pleasure reading the stories to the kids face to face. In fact, one of the best audiences I have ever had, large or small, was a group of about 400 black children at Hunter Elementary School on East Davies Street. Even in that size crowd, they were aware of every expression and every inflection. I remember my son Bill introducing me at Sherwood Bates School. I suppose it was a sign of their growing up that they not only quit inviting me to school, but quit telling their schoolmates that I was the fairy tale man. But everything goes around. Now my grandchildren book me into their schools. Maybe those kids and the ones who listened on the radio every morning enjoyed the fairy tales because I enjoyed them so much. Being able to do weird voices and strange sound effects appealed to the ham in me. And the stories appealed to me. They always had a happy ending. There was always a good guy and a bad guy. There was always action. But you knew, no matter how rough the action got, the good guys would win. Whether it was the pig dealing with the wolf or Hansel and Gretel dealing with the witch. Since these were live and unrehearsed, I found the best way to get tapes for the other stations was to tape my morning performances. I had 65 beautifully told tales on tape until one day while we were in Washington at an FCC hearing for Channel 5, the local program director needed some tapes and passed all 65 over the bulk eraser. Then there were none. One of the interesting things, though, is that fairy tale fame is not fleeting. Not long ago, more than 3 decades after my last And They Lived Happily Ever After, I handed a checkout lady in the supermarket a check for my groceries. I noticed that she was looking at it with more than usual interest, perhaps, I thought, because she was going to confuse me with some bad check artist. She looked at the check and looked at me. "Are you really Fred Fletcher?" she asked. I assured her that I was. "Are you the Fred Fletcher who was the fairy tale man on the radio?" When I admitted that I was indeed the fairy tale man, she told me that she used to listen to me every morning on the radio, and she accepted my check. The same thing happened in 1989 when a young telephone repairman came to the house to fix our phones. He told me that he had been raised in Fayetteville and listened to the fairy tales every morning on WFNC. It's nice to be remembered. And it's even nicer to be remembered for providing an enjoyable part of someone's childhood. The fairy tales stick with you. As I told an audience in 1985, I made a career out of reading fairy tales. Now I are one. Chapter 9. And back in the real world. The world of fairy tales was one thing. What was happening in the real world was something else entirely. The same year that I began the fairy tales, halfway around the world, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. We sat around our radio and listened to Franklin Roosevelt brand December 7 as "a day that will live in infamy," and asked Congress for a declaration of war. Living in a nation at war was one change in my life. A more immediate one was that on January 20, 1941, Margie and I became the parents of a daughter, Kay. The war was overseas. Kay was in our bedroom. 3 years later, our first son, Fred, was born, and 5 years after that, he was joined by his brother, Bill. Margie had quit her job to devote full time to mothering, and since the addition of Kay made our basement apartment too small for comfortable living, we bought a small 3-bedroom house from my father. The house was a prefabricated model from Sears and Roebuck. A.J. had originally built the house on Brooks Lane behind Fred Old's elementary school for his father, but Grandpa was a mountain man and Brooks Lane wasn't the Blue Ridge Mountains. He stuck it out for a few months before moving back to the mountains, leaving the house available for us. I'd like to say that I immersed myself in the care and raising of our 3 fine children, but if I did, Margie would quickly correct me. She contends, and can support her point with a lot of evidence, that I was so busy with WRAL, she did most of the raising single-handedly. However, I can cite specific instances of fathering. One of these was the time Margie came downtown and dropped Kay by the station to stay with me while she did some shopping. Kay was about 3 years old, blonde, beautiful, and energetic, and I was delighted to show her off around the station. But right after Margie left, I got a call and had to leave the station for a few minutes. I left Kay in the hands of my oldest salesman, Durham Moore. I had no doubt that Durham could handle a 3-year-old for 10 minutes. I was gone less than 10 minutes, but when I got back, Kay was nowhere to be seen. Durham was looking all over the station, muttering, "She was here 1 second, gone the next." I started looking and enlisted the help of everybody else who was standing around. We looked all over the station, in the offices, in the studios, in the record library, but we couldn't find Kay. I was beginning to feel more frantic by the minute. Kay was either lost or had been kidnapped. I called the police and reported her missing. I was about to put an announcement on the air when we got a call from Sarah Duncan, the wife of one of our engineers. She was doing her grocery shopping in the nearby Colonial store and had bumped into Kay, who seemed to be happily doing her 3-year-old shopping. I ran down to the Colonial store, grabbed Kay up, and hurried back to the station. When her mother came back from her shopping, we were, for all the world, quiet, content, safe, and happy. And we didn't tell Margie any different until much later. A small detail out of this story might serve as a lesson to younger readers about small city living. You'll remember I mentioned calling the police. Think about what would happen today if you called the police in any city and had a conversation like this. You. Police? My daughter's missing. She's gone. Police. Yes, sir. And how long has she been gone? You.
I don't know. It must be at least 10 minutes.
But I don't remember the man at the police station minimizing the problem or telling me to call back when she had been gone a day or two. I appreciated that. Generally, life for young marrieds was very simple in those days. We had one car, a few close friends, and not a lot of leisure time or extra money. So, except for some bridge or an occasional movie or sports event, life revolved around the job, the house, and the children. And, of course, the war. The actual shooting was thousands of miles away, but the war was very much in Raleigh, North Carolina. We had ration stamps, victory gardens, and V-mail. We saved scrap iron and stomped tin cans flat. We even had an occasional blackout drill, and we broadcast it from the top of the Sir Walter Hotel. When we did our remote broadcast from the North Carolina State Fair at the fairgrounds, we built a bomb shelter to house our equipment. And we all had friends whose family members had received their greetings and had gone off to war. Most of us had friends whose family members had received the terrible telegram that told them that someone was dead or missing in action. Radio news became even more important. H.B. Kaltenborn, Gabriel Heater, and a dozen others kept us informed on events in the European and Pacific theaters of operations. In thousands of homes around eastern North Carolina, there was silence while the whole family listened to the news. We posted typescripts of the war news on the window of the restaurant below the station, and one of Scotty Stevenson's saddest duties was to post the list of casualties that we got from the wire service every day. Crowds would gather on the sidewalk to see if someone they knew was listed as dead or missing. Like everyone else, WRAL and Tempest Fugit got involved in the war effort. We played transcription records furnished by the government promoting war bonds and recruiting. There was a spirit of community then that went far beyond the war. For instance, if a family lost their clothes and furnishings in a house fire, we would broadcast a plea for clothes, furniture, and money for the family and tell the listeners where to take it. The community never failed to hear a plea for help. Although the overwhelming theme of those years was the war, there were thousands of very personal sub-themes. Everyday life went on, every day. Looking back, it seems ironic that with all the momentous events going on around the world, I won the marble championship for the city of Raleigh. I suppose that even in war years, you have to have marble shooting champions. Not only did I win, but since I had been selected by the Civitans to present the Raleigh Times-sponsored trophy, I ended up presenting the trophy to myself. It was also in the middle of the war years that I was appointed to the city's Recreation Commission, beginning a lifelong involvement with Raleigh's recreation activities. My first job was to help form a teen club, a safe place for the local teenagers to gather and dance. The need for a teen club in Raleigh came from a collision of two huge forces, World War II and the concept of Southern womanhood. Almost everybody knows what World War II was, but there may be a few who do not remember or understand the concept of Southern womanhood. One Southern woman might be termed the flower of Southern womanhood. In Southern womanhood, there was, at least in the minds of the mothers, an inherent assumption of innocence. The girls should be protected from strangers, dangers, and Yankees. Unfortunately, World War II, because of Fort Bragg and Camp Lejeune, brought both strangers and Yankees to Raleigh, both of which were perceived by the mothers as being dangers. thus the need for a safe and chaperoned place where their daughters could boogie-woogie without fear. We found a building on Salisbury Street where the Oak City Laundry and its garage used to be, and we started cleaning it up. I remember crawling around on my hands and knees, scraping grease and gunk off the floor with a putty knife. Then we sanded and finished the floor, giving the kids a huge, slick, shiny dance floor. We also moved in a jukebox. Since I was general manager of WRAL and our hotspot program was one of the most popular with the teens, we had a natural channel for publicity. We ran promotions, telling the teens that they could have a place to go, people to see, and music to dance to by joining up and paying the dues, which were, I think, about $1 a month. We also received help from other Raleigh businesses, including a $1,000 contribution from the News and Observer. To help raise money, we also had a contest for Teen King and Teen Queen. Votes were a penny each, and you were encouraged to stuff the ballot box. The King and Queen were crowned on the night of the grand opening of the Raleigh Teenage Club. Chris Cole and Bob Riley reigned that night. The rules, as I remember them, were simple. You could dance, enjoy soft drinks and snacks from the snack bar, and stand around and talk. But you could not smoke, drink, or curse. Appropriate attire was expected. That sounds a little strange in these days when you see signs saying, "Shoes and shirts required," on the doors of businesses. You had to be a member or the guest of a member to attend, and no servicemen were allowed unless they were former members or the brother of a member. We had Miss Helen Cutting, the person hired by the new Recreation Commission to run the club, to make sure that the rules were followed, and on occasion I lent the place an air of age and dignity, or as much as my 32 years would allow. When we were creating and operating the teen club, we didn't think of it as having an important impact on anyone's life. It was a place to go and have a good time. But I know of at least one life that was changed dramatically by the club. One important fact in this story is that Raleigh had two high schools, Hugh Morrison and Needham Broughton, and only one teen club. Even though the students from the two schools were not always friendly, they had to get along at the club. Among the students were Francis Jones from Broughton and Bob Riley, the teen king, from Morrison. I knew they were there, but what follows comes from what Francis wrote me. It seems that Francis Jones was madly in love with Bob Riley, enough that she remembers nearly 50 years later that he was the first sergeant-at-arms on the teen club council. Bob was a Yankee from Ohio, a fact that, according to Francis, caused her grandmother to sniff that "he's not our kind of people." Frances disagreed and, in her southern ladylike way, pursued Bob. It was an unusual match, the two different schools, the outgoing boy and somewhat shy girl, the fact that Bob was, again according to Frances, one of the club's best dancers while she danced hardly at all. One day a council meeting had been called and Frances was sent to find her boyfriend, the sergeant-at-arms. When she got downstairs, she found him dancing with Bessie Cherry, the best girl dancer in the club. More than a little upset, Frances ran upstairs and out the door, heading home and out of Bob's life. At that point, according to her, I ran after her to find out what was wrong and talked her out of breaking up with Bob. Later, they were married, have been married more than 40 years, and have 5 children and 8 grandchildren. I honestly don't remember playing matchmaker between Frances and Bob, but I hope that it is just as she remembers it. The teen club also gave me a bit of personal recognition that I have treasured. Largely because of my work on the project, the Raleigh JCs gave me the JC Man of the Year Award. The war also gave me my only opportunity to go into the intelligence business, in the military sense. As I've already mentioned, Raleigh attracted servicemen from the bases around eastern North Carolina, Fort Bragg, Camp Lejeune, Seymour Johnson.